to the treaty. The Aramaic treaty cites the gods of both places. Spirit treaties to the Assyrian treaties. Similarities of the spirit treaties to the Hittite treaties. There are certain features of the Aramaic treaties that seem closer to the Hittite treaties. In the selection of gods called upon as witnesses to the treaty, the Aramaic treaty cites the gods of both places, the suzerain and the vassal, the great king and the vassal. The Hittite treaties also name the gods of both partners as witnesses. While the Assyrian treaties name only the Assyrian gods. And in other rather technical points of style of formulation that I won't go into, there's a lot of the phraseology that is closer to that of the Hittite treaties than to that of the Assyrian treaties. In style of formulation, you find certain segments of the Spirit treaties closer to the Hittite treaties than to the Assyrian. Conclusions regards the Spirit treaties. They exhibit certain close affinities with the earlier Hittite treaties, but at the same time, important differences, particularly the lack of a historical prologue and basic obligation. And the one-sided nature of the stipulation. I didn't mention that. But the one-sided nature of the stipulations, there are many more clauses which protect the rights of the head partner in the Sapiri treaties as compared to the Hittite treaty. Not to exclusion of obligations of the head partner, but much more than in the Hittite treaty. Three here, implications of the treaty covenant analogy for the date of Deuteronomy. It would seem to draw this together that present evidence does indicate that the Hittite suzerainty treaties represent a unique early form of the treaty document that is not duplicated in the later treaties either of Esarhaddon or Sapiri. What Klein calls his classic form. And connected with that difference in form is the distinctive spirit reflected in the Hittite treaties. Grounded in the fact that the gratitude and respect of the vassal for the suzerain is an essential characteristic of the treaty relationship. Quite different in both the Assyrian and the Sapiri treaties. So that Klein, I believe, speaks with good reason of the evolution of the documentary form of the suzerainty treaty. And while the differences should not be exaggerated, and Klein admits that, he says it is indeed one species that we meet throughout Old Testament times. In spite of that one species, in certain parallel elements, there are these differences that can be pointed to. And I think that there is reason to find this discernible evolution. And then Deuteronomy corresponds more closely in its structure and spirit to the earlier Hittite treaties than it does to either the 8th century Sapiri treaties or the 7th century Assyrian treaties. That's the thesis. So Klein's conclusion, page 43 of the Treaty of the Great King, I think has a great deal of merit. Deserves more attention than it's received. And he puts it this way. He says that while it is necessary to recognize a substantial continuity and pattern between the earlier and later treaties, it is proper to distinguish the Hittite treaties of the second millennium BC as the classic form. And without any doubt, the book of Deuteronomy belongs to the classic stage in this documentary evolution. Here then is significant confirmation of the prima facie case for the Mosaic origin of the Deuteronomic Treaty of the Great King. So that's the nature of Klein's argument, and that's the basis on which it rests. And I think he's made a good case. Now, our time is quickly running out, but let me, before getting into responses of some contemporary critical scholars who reject this conclusion and why, just mention J.A. Thompson again. Now, some of you may have already read this. In his commentary on Deuteronomy, that's in the Tyndale Old Testament Commentary series, pages 51 and 52, that's in that introductory section, he expresses reservations about the strength of Klein's argument. Here's what he said. A quote. The possibility must be allowed that Deuteronomy was cast in the shape of an ancient treaty by someone who wrote long after Moses' day. Someone writing late, putting the material in the form, the earlier form. In addition, he questions the view that the historical prologue was uniquely characteristic of the treaties of the second millennium BC, citing an article by A.F. Campbell, an historical prologue in the 7th century treaty. Now, as I indicated just a few minutes ago, the historical prologue within the Hittite treaties is not in any presently known 7th or 8th century treaty. Thompson cites an article by A.F. Campbell, an historical prologue in the 7th century treaty. And Thompson then concludes, hence the fact that Deuteronomy has a historical introduction is not necessarily an argument for a date in the second millennium, although it may be. In other words, if you have a treaty back here with a historical prologue, the fact that you have the historical prologue here is not necessarily an argument for this, although it may be. Now, in response to that, I think it should be noted that the historical prologue found by this man Campbell that he cites in the 7th century document is not a clear-cut example. And I could refer you to an article that discusses that and goes into it in detail. A comment by another fellow gets very confusing, an E.F. Campbell, as compared to an A.F. Campbell. Two different articles, two different periodicals. The E.F. Campbell says the reading is far from clear. The one that is suggesting that there is a historical prologue back here. In addition, I think this ought to be noted, that while the possibility that someone cast Deuteronomy in the shape of the treaty form long after Moses' day cannot be totally ruled out, you can't totally rule that out as a theoretical possibility. True, somebody could have, in late time, used the treaty form, put the material in there. You can't rule that out as a possibility. Still, Klein's position is scarcely invalidated in this way, and his model still has a great deal of evidence in his favor. Klein comments in his more recent book, The Structure of Biblical Authority, page 10, quote, if it is once recognized that the Deuteronomic Treaty must have been produced whole for a particular occasion, the pervasive orientation of the book to the situation of Israel in the Mosaic Age, and especially the central concern of this treaty with, of all things, the dynastic succession of Joshua, succession Moses-Joshua, always awkward for advocates of the 7th century origin of the book, becomes quite inexplicable for them. In other words, you're going to take the structure of Deuteronomy as a whole, with all that pushes it towards Mosaic here, and particularly that matter of dynastic succession of Joshua and Moses, that becomes quite inexplicable for someone that wants to hold the 7th century origin, utilizing the form back here, rather than including that the historical setting, which the book itself claims to have, is not a far better explanation for the origin and use of the form. Well, our time is up. This has taken me much longer than I anticipated because I wanted to discuss, before your presentation starts, this matter of centralization of worship. And I only have three more class hours. No, I only have two more class hours. I may not make it, but...
What's the open class?
Yeah, maybe... I figured that even in our presentation, time has a way of going by so quickly and you get jammed up, and I was certain that we're going to need some time to get caught up with one thing or another, so I left a couple open hours. Well, next class hour, we'll look at the responses of some contemporary critical scholars who reject this conclusion. Where do they go with this model? Okay. Yeah. Well, what I would like is, say, a presentation of maybe 35 minutes or a chance for discussion. Now, I may make some comments, I may not. Depends on the class reaction situation.
Deuteronomy says correspond the signpost to the classic stage, the evolution of the tree. And we noted that then under A, comparison of the Assyrian and Aramaic treaties with the Hittite treaties and any implications which they may have for the date of Deuteronomy.
That brought us then to the last point on your sheet, small b at the bottom, responses of some contemporary critical scholars who reject the conclusion that the evolution of this treaty form points toward a Mosaic origin for the Book of Deuteronomy. Responses then of some contemporary scholars that have followed this whole discussion and question coming to that conclusion. Now, we can't do this in detail, and I want to get on this morning into our next topic, which is centralization of worship, but we'll see how it goes. A man named J.C. Plasteras, Plastaras, in the Catholic Biblical Quarterly, 1967. It's a useful journal, though, because there are lots of articles on really biblical subjects that you find that sometimes are quite useful and helpful. Yeah. No. I presume many of them are. Many times you'll see the SJ after their name or something that sort of identifies them as being Catholic. Sometimes you don't know what they are, the contributors. But J.C. Plasteras reviews K.A. Kitchen's Ancient Orient and Old Testament. Now that book you're familiar with, in that issue of the Catholic Biblical Quarterly. Kitchen in Ancient Orient and Old Testament really takes a very similar position to Klein, arguing on the basis of the treaty structure to the Mosaic era for the origin of Deuteronomy. Plasteras says, and I'll just quote a paragraph from him, he, Kitchen, argues against D.J. McCarthy and in favor of the earlier, unnuanced position of G.E. Mendenhall, that the treaty forms, similar to the Old Testament covenant traditions, were current only during the second millennium, but not afterwards. Well and good. But then Kitchen goes on to conclude that the covenant narratives could not have taken fixed literary forms only in the 9th to 6th centuries, since the writers could have had no knowledge of the long-since obsolete covenant forms. Kitchen seems to have overlooked the very essential fact that no matter at what date the Hittite covenant form may have gone out of current use in the ancient Near East, Israel would always have retained the same basic covenant form in her cult, so that every layer of tradition, J, E, D, or the redactional combination of these earlier sources would all reflect the same basic covenant structures. What he's really arguing is simply this, that he said, all right, the form that we find in the biblical materials corresponds in the evolution of this treaty thing to the Hittite form back here. But what he's saying is, Kitchen's argument presumes that Israel couldn't have picked up the form much later, having this form preserved in some fashion in her cult, and then adopted at a much later point in time. So that to argue that Deuteronomy must be composed back here, he says, ignores this possibility of preservation in the cult. Deuteronomy still could have been composed later. Now, I think that you have to grant that as a theoretic possibility. But I think what that position leaves open is the question of when the covenant form was adopted in Israel. Where did this form in the cult come from? When was it originally adopted in Israel? And in addition, the objections we made earlier towards some simply cultic derivation of the form that de-emphasizes the historical setting and occasion and basis for the whole covenant relationship certainly is also to be brought to bear on this. Is some cultic origin hypothesis, does it do justice to it? And even if you assume it, where did that come from? So you still, I think, are faced with the force of Klein's position. So that has to be considered. But even granting this, the Plasterus, or Plasterus, however it's pronounced, his position does not exclude an early date possibility, but merely provides a rationale for a late date in view of the admitted antiquity of the form. He's just giving a rationale for holding on to this late date, admitting the antiquity of the form. It doesn't force you into a late date thing. It really gives a rationale for a late date while admitting that it could be looked at in the other way. So there is a certain inconclusiveness to this kind of argumentation. I think you have to keep that in mind, even arguing for the Mosaic thing. You don't ultimately prove in any sort of final sense that Deuteronomy is Mosaic by arguing on the basis of these forms. I think you build a case that has a lot of weight to it. Now, so that's one representative of an objection to this position and the reasoning that he follows. Question?
Do you think that the later Israelis in the 7th century realized this form for Deuteronomy, that it was a covenant form?
No, but I'd say that the persistence in finding this form at all stages and all kinds of different applications through Israel's history points toward that conclusion. For example, you take the prayer of Solomon at the time of the dedication of the temple in 1 Kings 8. And the prayer roughly follows this form. Now, I'm sure that Solomon was not consciously thinking of treaties or even perhaps it was the Sinai Deuteronomy covenant document or anything like that. But the character of Israel's faith and the sequence of this, I've done this for you, you have these obligations, these kinds of blessings, these kinds of curses, that sort of a thing was so embedded in the very nature of the way Israel worshiped the Lord and thought of the Lord, that it reflects itself in many ways. And you find that all through Israel's history. So it seems to me the only alternative is if you're going to say that That whole business is back here. Then, of course, you take Solomon's Prayer and say, Solomon's Prayer really was not prayed in that form. That is a late construction of what the late Deuteronomist mystically influenced historian thought Solomon may have said or would have liked him to have said. You start wrenching everything out of the context in which it's presently found. It's extremely complicated. All right, another person that has raised an issue is R. Frankina.
R. Frankina.
This is on your bibliography. So I won't take time to give you the full title and detail right here on the board. The Vassal Treaties of Esarhaddon and the Dating of Deuteronomy is an article. The Vassal Treaties of Esarhaddon, that's the late Assyrian treaties. And the Dating of Deuteronomy. That is in this volume, which I just took off the reserve shelf. It's on the reserve shelf, if you want to read the article. Alt Testamentis Studien, that's Old Testament Studies, volume 14. These are collections of articles. They appear yearly. Many of the articles are in English. This article is. There are a lot of useful articles in these 14 volumes, or more now, that come out yearly. We have a good collection of them. This is in volume 14, 1965, pages 122 to 154. He argues in his article on the Vassal Treaties of Esarhaddon for a 7th century date for Deuteronomy on the basis of certain points of correspondence between curse formulations in the Treaties of Esarhaddon and in Deuteronomy. Certain curse formulations that are found in the Esarhaddon Treaties, he points out, have close similarities in some of the curses, Deuteronomy chapter 28. His conclusion is, this is page 153, the religious reform of Josiah was directed against Assyria, and it is therefore tempting to regard the renewed covenant with Yahweh as a substitution of the former treaty with the king of Assyria. That the text of this covenant should betray knowledge of the Assyrian treaties, which it seems to replace, seems only natural to me. The dating of Deuteronomy, moreover, would in that case find corroboration in a rather unexpected way. In the time of Josiah, was at that time a sort of with the Assyrian power declining, Israel asserting its independence, and in that sense, Deuteronomy being a treaty document of allegiance to Yahweh, no longer allegiance to Assyria. But the writer of Deuteronomy, as Frankina develops it, almost copied, modifying of course, but almost copied a lot of these curses right out of the Assyrian treaty text that was familiar to him. So the Deuteronomy is subsequent to and dependent upon the Assyrian treaties of Esarhaddon. And he argues on that basis for a date and time of Josiah, rather than Mosaic. Now the interesting thing is, he never discusses the implications of the differences that we've talked about in structure between the Hittite treaties and the Assyrian treaties. He just doesn't discuss that. The lack of the historical prologue, for example. He makes one comment that even closely bears on that subject. Page 136, he says, the omission of the blessings in the Assyrian treaties might be due to the fact that the treaty would bestow automatically blessings on the faithful vassal. In other words, he recognizes that difference. There were blessings in the Hittite treaties, they're not in the Assyrian treaties. Why aren't there blessings in the Assyrian treaties? Well, maybe the idea is that the treaty would automatically bestow blessings on the faithful vassal. But he really doesn't get into any discussion of how you're going to explain the difference in total structure and form if the Deuteronomy document is essentially borrowed from the Assyrian document. Now, Klein was aware of this article of Frankenmuth by the time he wrote his book, The Structure of Biblical Authority. And in Klein's book, The Structure of Biblical Authority, he says, as for the similarities of a group of Deuteronomic curses to a section of curses in the later treaties, this is not adequate evidence to date even this particular material late. Now why? He says, for the tradition of curse formularies extends far back into the second millennium BC. In other words, there is a traditional way of formulating curses, and that kind of stereotype traditional way of doing that is something that goes way back. Moreover, since the critics in question suppose that Deuteronomy developed over a period of time through a process of additions and modifications, they would be in no position to appeal to the presence of demonstrably 7th century curse formulations, if there were such, as compelling evidence for the late origin of the treaty structure of the book as a whole. So that it seems to me that the point to be made is, you can look at the formulations yourself if you want to look at this in detail and see how forceful you think it is. There are general similarities. The wording is different, it's been modified, but similar kinds of curses. It seems to me that's to be explained much more readily by the rather stereotyped, common nature of curses in the ancient Near East generally, included in the Book of Deuteronomy, which goes back even into the Hittite treaties, rather than on the dependence on the late Assyrian treaties. And much more important, Frankenmuth says nothing about the explanation for the correspondence and structure of Deuteronomy with the Hittite treaties as compared to the Assyrian treaties. Kitchen, Ancient Orient and Old Testament, comments on Frankenmuth's article in a footnote, page 100. He says, useful comparisons between the curses of Deuteronomy and the Neo-Assyrian treaties are made by R. Frankenmuth and Moshe Weinfeld. However, they betray some naivete in assuming that similarity automatically spells Hebrew dependence on late Assyrian usage. The old Babylonian data cited by Weinfeld already point toward a different answer to a long-standing tradition going well back into the second millennium at least, which could have been known in the Westlands even before Moses. He argues the same way. And I think the point is a legitimate point. But you should be aware that this treaty material has been used by Frankenmuth and I'll mention later Moshe Weinfeld both to argue for a late date treaty. Gerhard von Rad, I won't go into detail again. We've discussed his view. He's seen this structure. He admits the structure is analogous to the treaty structure. There must be a relationship, but he holds on to this sort of cultic origin theory, which is what there and figures a late thing, not so much tying into the late Assyrian treaties, but in his view, the whole development of the book is such, with all these layers of material, that the structure is rooted in the cult with a long process of development. He doesn't say how far it goes or what the original cause was, but it's that cultic origin sort of viewpoint. Another man, recent book on Deuteronomy, B.W. Nicholson. B.W. Nicholson. Deuteronomy and Tradition, it's entitled. Very similar to Von Rod, but with slight deviation. He concludes, the form in which Deuteronomy is cast derives from the cult, follows the liturgical pattern of the festival of the renewal of the covenant. But in his view, the Levites are not the ones who are really responsible for the preaching that you find in Deuteronomy and the preservation material. But he regards prophetic circles in northern Israel as the responsible agents for the preservation and transmission of the traditions underlying the book. Prophetic circles in northern Israel. For the ones that preserve this kind of material, develop the material. He suggests that these circles of prophets fled to the south after the destruction of the northern kingdom. In other words, after 722. And eventually drew up their program for reform during the time of Manasseh, depositing their book in the temple in Jerusalem, where it was found during the reign of Josiah. So prophetic circles from the north developed this material. After 722, they come south. They draw up a program for reform, which is basically what you have in Deuteronomy. That was deposited in the temple and eventually found during the reign of Josiah. So it's, in a sense, basically the old Wellhausen position, but instead of saying it was all late material composed right approximately at the time of 621, it's got a long history behind it. And this whole prophetic movement is behind it, developing it. The original form comes out of the cult. How far back that goes, where that originated, it's left open. One last name. Moshe Weinfeld, rather important name.
There's a, I think that's on the
Deuteronomy and the Deuteronomic School. I believe it's Oxford University Press, 19, just recently came out, in the last few years. I don't have the date here. But Deuteronomy and the Deuteronomic School, Moshe Weinfeld. He has opposed any cultic derivation view of the covenant form. He's opposed that. In other words, including Von Rod or Nicholson or whoever. What is that? Something new. He says that the structure of Deuteronomy follows a literary tradition of covenant writing rather than imitating a periodical cultic ceremony. In other words, there's a literary tradition behind the structure of Deuteronomy, not some sort of cultic ceremony behind the structure. And instead of then ascribing the book to Levitical or prophetical circles, Levitical circles, Von Rod, prophetical circles, Nicholson. He attributes it to the court scribes of the time of Hezekiah and Josiah. The court scribes of the time of Hezekiah and Josiah. He says, and I quote, if a literary pattern lies behind the book of Deuteronomy, the form of Deuteronomy, it would be much more reasonable to assume that a literary circle, which was familiar with treaty writing, in other words, court scribes, composed the book of Deuteronomy. Now, Weinfeld rejects the view of Mendenhall-Bright, Klein, Albright, that group of scholars. He rejects the view that the Hittite treaty form is unique, and that the covenant form of Deuteronomy, therefore, corresponds closely with the classic form of the second millennium. He rejects that view. He says the treaty form is basically one form all the way through. He dismisses the lack of a historical prologue in the Assyrian treaties as not significant. Simply dismisses that. It's not important that there's no historical prologue. Well, you could debate that. I think it's enormously important. We already discussed that. So that he concludes, really in agreement with Frankenau, although on a slightly different basis, he agrees that Deuteronomy reflects contemporary Assyrian treaties rather than the earlier Hittite treaties. He rejects this idea of evolution of a documentary form of treaties, concludes that Deuteronomy has a literary background, it's a product of the scribes in Jerusalem. The scribes in Jerusalem were familiar with Assyrian treaties. It's the Assyrian treaties that are behind Deuteronomy. That's basically his thesis. Klein, in his Structure of Biblical Authority, comments on Weinfeld. Page 14, the Structure of Biblical Authority. And says, and I quote, "The oration character of Deuteronomy, Weinfeld explains, is a literary device." Deuteronomy does have an oration character. Moses is giving these addresses, these speeches. Weinfeld explains that as a literary device. Programmatic speeches were placed in the mouths of famous persons to express the ideological views of the author. Now that's really Wellhausen again. Same kind of an idea. That is programmatic speech placed in the mouth of Moses, placed in the mouth of Joshua, placed in the mouth of Samuel. That's all from late time representatives being early. On this point, Klein says, von Rad comes closer to the truth. For while he too deems fictional the casting of Deuteronomy in the form of a farewell speech of Moses, he does at least formally integrate this feature with the covenantal elements in the book. He identifies the speech of as an office bearer's farewell. You have Moses there giving his farewell. Von Rad advocates that. And he explains the presence of the covenant formulary within this and other such speeches by reference to the attested practice of renewing covenants when vassal leaders transferred their office to a successor. Unfortunately, von Rad fails to recognize in the oration form the true explanation of the hortatory trend in the Deuteronomic Treaty. This feature does not derive from Levitical preaching, nor from a late literary circle of court scribes, but from the historical circumstance that Deuteronomy is the documentary deposit of a covenant renewal, which was also Moses' farewell to Israel. The element of paronesis, or exhortation, already present to some extent in the ancient treaties, was naturally exploited to the fullest by Moses on that stirring occasion. So that's basically Klein's response to Weinfeld, that the situation in which you have Moses giving an address to the people at the point of his departure on occasion of a covenant renewal is a far better situation in life to which to ascribe the origin of the book of Deuteronomy than court scribes sitting in Jerusalem in the time of Josiah copying from Assyrian treaty guide. Structure of Biblical Authority is the book he has written. Page 14. The Structure of Biblical Authority. What he does in that book, I don't know if you're familiar with the book, he takes this idea of this treaty covenant analogy and the concept that in treaty documents, the text was something that was not to be tampered with. Once it was put down, it was set. It was not to be added to, detracted from, changed, modified. And he sort of takes that idea and applies it to the idea of canon in Scripture. That once Scripture is written and given, it's something that does not go through all this process of reformulation. So the Structure of Biblical Authority is the title of the book. Okay, I'd like to sort of conclude our discussion of this literary structure and scope of the book of Deuteronomy, the historical implications of that. Some questions?
Did the higher spiritual God have any qualms with the data of his history?
No, there's never been any challenge to that. That's pretty well established, and no, there's very little discussion of that. It's just not an issue.
I think it's made that Saul seeing truth as one end of the room, and if that truth is another, and then it's the Bible and the point. If they have any facts to get the truth and the point, if they have to agree with it, then it's the truth.
Well, you get into the thing that the debate turns on, say, would be several things.
Starting with prologue. How important is that? Syrian treaties don't matter. Hittite treaties do. Biblical covenants do, obviously. Weinfeld, his argument for this Assyrian thing, says this really makes no difference. The form is still one form. Well, I don't think he's done justice to the significance, not simply of the presence of this element in the form, but the function of it in the form. Seems to be enormously important. You can't just cross that out and compare the material with the Assyrian treaties and just sort of ignore this as an issue. But that's one point of debate. Is the form of treaties from Hittites down to Assyrian one, or is there a development change? And there's a division of conclusion on that. Even with those, however, secondly, who would say the form does change, the biblical material relates to the Hittite material as far as form, the earlier material. All those who do that and recognize that aren't willing then to say that that necessarily means the biblical material is early, because they can do this. They can say it was derived at a later point, even though the form itself may go back early. But then you haven't answered this question. When and where and why did that form become a part of Israelite tradition? Even that Deuteronomy, you say, was taken at some late point in the history of preservation of this form in the cult, or preservation by the Levites, or preservation by the prophets, or who. But where did that start then? That's the question I think has to be asked. And what situation in the history of Israel can you posit other than the conclusion of the covenant at Sinai after deliverance out of Egypt that really gives you a legitimate explanation for entrance of that form into Israelite use? And I think there that is the strength of Klein's argument, not to the point of conclusive proof, but certainly the most satisfactory model that deals with all the factors involved. Any further discussion on this? Yeah. The same things that are called the effects in Genesis for Abraham.
Probably is. Although at that point, they would not have reached strength as an empire that they did subsequent to that. But it would seem like it would be the same peoples who had perhaps settled on Palestine in the time of Abraham. I'd like to go on then to the matter of centralization of worship. You could make this Roman numeral 3 on your outline. Centralization of worship and its implications for the date of Deuteronomy. I'd like to go on then to the matter of centralization of worship. You could make this Roman numeral 3 on your outline. Centralization of worship and its implications for the date of Deuteronomy. I think what I will do here is sort of present to you initially the content of an article, which I think is an excellent article in this book, by a man named D. Hallwerker, who was a Dutch Old Testament scholar who died in his early 40s about 10 years ago. He was a young scholar at the point of his death, and had begun to publish and do some tremendous work, but the Lord took him. He wrote an article on this issue. It's published in this little book. That is, it's only available in Dutch. I sort of boiled down the essence of it, at least initially, I wanted to give you that, because I think he sets up the problem nicely and you get a handle on the issues involved. The title of his article is "The Place Which the Lord Your God Shall Choose." The place which the Lord your God shall choose. Now you recognize that as coming from Deuteronomy chapter 12. He says, few Bible readers realize that in this phrase, we are confronted with the root problem of modern Old Testament study. Yet that is the case. Now, he may slightly over-exaggerate and overstate his case, but I think there's some value in doing that. The root problem of modern Old Testament studies is in this phrase, the place where the Lord your God shall choose. This is so because it is this phrase concerning the legitimate place of worship in Israel which formed the key to the first part of Wellhausen's work on the history of Israel that later became his book, The Prolegomena to the History of Israel. That book went through several editions. But the key to that work, Prolegomena to the History of Israel, centers around this phrase. They call where to see. He says that one can say that this study, Prolegomena of the History of Israel, was the great turning point in Old Testament study. And in spite of criticism of detail subsequent to the time which that was published, changes in method of research, progress and all that, it still keeps its dominant position until the present day. So that thanks to Wellhausen, Deuteronomy 12 has become the springboard for a completely destructive criticism of the Bible that has left almost nothing of the Old Testament intact. And see, what Hallward is doing is attaching then just enormous significance to Wellhausen's interpretation of Deuteronomy 12 as the core of his whole thesis. He says, what is more remarkable is that Wellhausen gave an exegesis of Deuteronomy 12, which for the most part has the agreement of the majority of Bible-believing exegetes. Wellhausen gave an exegesis to Deuteronomy 12, which for the most part has the agreement of the majority of Bible-believing exegetes. He read Deuteronomy 12 in the sense that all the offerings of Israel were to be bound to one sanctuary at a central place of worship, which ultimately became the temple. All the offerings were bound to that one place of central worship, and every altar outside of Jerusalem was illegal. Every offering which someone brought at a high place, for example, was illegal. Why? Because it was not brought at the place which the Lord had chosen. So that Deuteronomy 12, according to Wellhausen, and according to most Bible-believing exegetes, demanded the centralization of worship. And Deuteronomy 12 meant that worship was forbidden in any place other than that central sanctuary. Exclusive rights were at the temple. The point in which Wellhausen and most Bible-believing scholars differed is that while the latter maintained Moses as the writer of Deuteronomy 12, Wellhausen placed the writing in the time of Josiah, who was the first one to get rid of the high places and restrict offerings to the temple in Jerusalem. So that what Howard is positing here is basic agreement between Bible-believing exegetes and Wellhausen on the meaning and interpretation of the chapter requiring centralization of worship. But the Bible-believing exegetes would say Moses wrote that, the others, Wellhausen, would say Josiah, it was written in the time of Josiah, and he was the one, first one who tried to wipe out the high places and exclusively center worship in Jerusalem. So that from the Orthodox side, the chapter would be placed in the time of Moses, 12 to 1400. Wellhausen side, time of Josiah, 621. Wellhausen's reason for 621 is this regulation is impossible to conceive of any earlier. This regulation is impossible to conceive of any earlier. His theory was based on the view that the place of worship went through three discernible stages when you study the historical sections of the Old Testament. If you look at the historical sections of the Old Testament, three discernible phases of evolution concerning the place of worship. First stage, the first phase was this. First phase, the altar was not tied to a specific place. There are many altars, many places of worship. In the time of Judges and Samuel, you find many altars in use. It appears that the people took over the high places of the Canaanites, and no one had objection to altars at almost any location. At the time of Samuel, he offers at a high place for him. So that religious observances could be held most anywhere. Wellhausen said that later there was a desire to give divine approval to the existing places of worship by asserting that their origin was due to an appearance of the Lord at a particular place. In other words, a theophany or something connected with a spot, legitimized that spot. So you have Bethel, the Lord has appeared to Jacob, therefore that's a legitimate spot to worship. The Lord has appeared to Abraham at Shechem, that's a legitimate spot to worship. That sort of thing. No, this is still the first phase. But with multiplicity of altars, but within that progression of this idea of association of theophany with a spot to legitimize. But in this first phase, there's no thought of worship being bound to one place to the exclusion of all others. And in Wellhausen's idea of the early, more free kind of worship, you have this spontaneous kind of religion. In every occasion of life that would give rise for an expression of thanksgiving, there was an altar close by and sacrifices were performed. But then slowly, a change began to set in. We're still not to the second phase, but change begins to set up. Under the influence of the early prophets, Amos and Hosea, criticism began to rise against the unbridled cult. And with the rise of the prophetic movement, they began to proclaim that true worship was not the offering of the blood of bulls and goats, but it was ethical living. The prophets didn't desire cultic activity. They wanted a proper way of life. They wanted ethics. It wasn't that they opposed multiplicity of altars as such, but they saw a danger in a religion that laid stress on the cult, because the moral demands of God did not get their due when people kept flocking to the altar going through all the ceremonies. And thanks to this opposition of the prophets, this is all Wellhausen's theory, Hallward is sort of summarizing. Thanks to this opposition of the prophets, the high places lost their significance. Moreover, the political situation slowly led Jerusalem to come to the foreground. After the fall of Samaria in 722, no longer competition from the northern kingdom as concerns cultic observance. And about the same time, the prophet Isaiah proclaimed in the south the unassailable position of Jerusalem. Jerusalem begins to get center of attention by the time of Isaiah. All of these factors together led to the second phase, in which Jerusalem and her temple become dominant. Wellhausen said it was understood that a radical abolition of the entire cult could not succeed. So there was an attempt at reformation and concentration. You can't entirely obliterate the cult. Prophets were opposed to it. You couldn't entirely obliterate it. So the attempt was to concentrate it, reform it, and that prophetic influence was behind this development, but even though the prophets and the priests were deadly enemies, basically, two different spheres of religious concern, and the priests, the prophets were against the priests and all this cult, yet the prophets and the priests worked together in this matter of reformation and concentration. They had a mutual interest there, because the priests in Jerusalem had a great material advantage from concentration of worship in the capital. And the prophets promoted the same also in connection with their monotheistic concept of God, where you need really to stop talking, as Wellhausen saw, of a God of Bethel, a God of Beersheba, a God of all these different places, but if there's one God, then there's one legitimate place of worship. So through this common influence, prophetic influence, priestly influence, that all comes to bear on the attempt of Josiah to wipe out the worship at the high places and at every place in the land except Jerusalem. And that was his great reformation in 621. That's the second phase. Still, to move on to the third phase. Yet that attempt was doomed to failure. People were attached to the holy places. As soon as Josiah died, worship returned to these places. And the Reformation would never have had a remaining effect, according to Wellhausen, if it had not been for the exile. Because with the exile, the people were uprooted completely, taken out of the land, and the whole worship system was broken off. So that when Cyrus in 539 gave the edict that permitted a return, there was a generation that had never been able to sacrifice at all. They hadn't grown up with the old practices of earlier times. And only at that point was there a generation of people who could dedicate their heart and soul to the accomplishment of the reform ideas of the centralized cult. So that brings in the third phase. The exile made this complete break with the past. after the exile then, in the return, the people no longer thought of establishing high places, but they just accepted as self-evident the goal of the prophets and the priests before, that there should be one place of worship, and that was at Jerusalem in the temple. That's the third phase, the post-exilic time of real adherence to this thing that really never was accomplished prior to that, except for that brief attempt by Josiah. Now, I've got to stop because our time is up. But we want to go a little bit further with setting the background to Wellhausen's position so you understand the key role that this chapter plays. And then see what the chapter says and what we do with that. And I was trying to summarize for you an article written by a man named Paul Wurtis on the place which the Lord your God shall choose and the significance which he attaches to the interpretation of Deuteronomy chapter 12 in connection with Wellhausen's whole structure of his JDC theory. And in the process of that, he begins by mentioning that Wellhausen's theory went through three discernible phases with relation to the history of worship in Israel. So that there was the first phase in which there was multiplicity of sanctuaries. There was the second phase where through the influence of the prophets, you come to the opposition toward multiplicity of sanctuaries and centralization of worship. And then that was not entirely successful until after the exile. When you come to the post-exilic time, you come to the third phase where you do have the establishment of the central exclusive place of worship. So that was generally the development that he sketched, and we discussed that in the last class hour. So to pick up from that point then, these phases of history of Israel's worship in connection with place of worship, multiplicity of altars, centralization of altar, whatever. There's that progression that Wellhausen saw. Now to continue. He said, Wellhausen that is, said that not only did the history move in these three phases, but we discover the same three phases in the law given. Not only did the history move in that sequence, but in the laws of Israel, you find the same three phases represented. The reason he says that is that the altar law of Exodus 20 corresponds to the first period, multiplicity of altars. The altar law of Exodus 20. Now, Exodus 20 occurs in the Book of the Covenant. And in verses 24 through 26 of Exodus 20, you read, "An altar of earth shalt thou make unto me, shalt sacrifice thereon thy burnt offerings, thy peace offerings, thy sheep, thine oxen, in all places where I record my name. I will come unto thee, and I will bless thee, and if thou wilt make me an altar of stone, thou shalt not build it, a hewn stone, for if thou lift up the tool upon it, thou hast polluted it. Neither shalt thou go up by steps unto mine altar, that thy nakedness be not exposed thereon. But in all the places where I record thy name, he will come unto them, and the altars that were built in various places should correspond with the description that is laid out there." But according to Wellhausen, the altar law of Exodus 20 presumes multiplicity of altars corresponds to the first period, or the first phase. That law he attributed to J and D. J&E documents and said that the picture of multiplicity of altars reflected there corresponds to the historical picture as provided by those two sources. Now, when you move further, Deuteronomy 12, according to Wellhausen, commands destruction of the heathen places of offering and commands that the Lord be worshipped in one place. So that Deuteronomy then, and the law in Deuteronomy 12, corresponds to the second phase of historical development. And of course, as we've discussed before, he placed that at 621 when Josiah promoted his reformation. Of his JEDP sources, that leaves then only P. And according to Wellhausen, P is clearly later than D, because in D, since centralization is explicitly commanded, and thus still must fight against existing contrary practices, but P does not lay stress on that anymore. P just assumes it to be so normal that there is only one place, that according to it, there was never any other way since the time of Moses. Just a matter of assumption. There's one place of worship, and he just, not a matter of conflict with multiplicity of altars, just assume there's one place of worship. Everybody's in agreement with that. And he then assigns that to the third phase of Proto-Joic time, as being the origin for that. Now, he finds that sequence also confirmed by other matters. We don't want to get into all that. But Wellhausen, the force of Wellhausen's system is not simply on one single point, but he brought to bear on issues coming at it from a lot of different directions. And his evolution of the history of Israel's worship is the sort of come to that conclusion on the basis of a lot of converging lines of evidence. And this is one factor that is key to it. This progression in relation to place of worship, not only historically, but also legally. The one firm date, and we discussed this before, 621, and that's the document. So he works back from 621 to earlier time, and he works the other direction subsequent to 621 to date this material. Now, of course, the result does havoc to the entire Old Testament. Because what serves as foundation for the structure of the Old Testament, namely the Pentateuch, he divides into J, D, and P, and none of it any longer is foundational. Because Moses, rather than being the foundation for all that follows, Moses is the result. He's the outcome. He's the final point that is reached in the history of Old Testament religion. Say Moses and Fulton, not the real Moses. Religion in the older times was no different than Canaanite religion. And the Lord was simply a god, no different from other Canaanite gods. So that the starting point for Wellhausen's system is not Mosaic revelation, but early Semitic heathenism. Start out with that, rather than Mosaic revelation. Start out with early Semitic heathenism. And what Wellhausen's system is it runs from that heathenism up to Moses. So what, according to the biblical structure, is the beginning, the Mosaic here, the Mosaic revelation, for Wellhausen is the end. That's where everything is moving. Particularly as you come into the prophetic movement, prophetic idea of monotheism, centralization of worship, and ultimately the working out of the implications of that in the Levitical legislation and the detailed ritual. That's the final point. In the process of doing that, changing, you see the whole structure and line of progress, the prophets are left hanging in the air. Because prophets then are no more reformers standing on the foundation of Moses. The prophets don't proclaim the old ways and call the people back to them. The prophets are innovators. They're proclaiming new ways. So that the function of the prophets is not to defend and proclaim the way of Moses, you might say, that originally had been revealed over against heathen, and to call Israel to the back to their origins as distinct from heathen origins. But the prophets lead the people by their ethical preaching from early heathenism and bring them finally to Moses. That's what the Wellhausen scheme does. They lead the people by their ethical preaching out of heathenism and really bring them to Moses. In quotes, the Moses of Wellhausen's system. Now that's basically Hallwerder's assessment of Wellhausen's system. I think it gives you some insight into it. Gives you somewhat of a handle on it that is useful. If you read his Prolegomena of the History of Ancient Israel, it's an enormously complex book. And I think this presentation of Hallwerder is helpful in seeing some of the implications of it. But then his comment is that the history of opposition to Wellhausen's theory is mostly directed against various details of his system rather than getting at the heart of it. And of course, knocking the details of it are useful too. But according to Hallwerder's approach here, the heart of the system is the centralization issue. And that's the key point in the whole system. And that's why, as I mentioned, he said at the beginning of his article, few Bible readers realize that in this phrase, the place where the Lord your God shall choose, we are confronted with the root problem of modern Old Testament study. So that's why he feels there's such significance to that. Now, as I also mentioned, I think maybe Hallwerder has overstated his case. But still, there is something here that has enormous implications. Now, what he goes on to do with this, then. He points out that there are examples in the historical book covering the time from the judges up to and including the time of the kingdom period where multiplicity of altars is obviously referred to. From the time of the judges up to the time of the kingdom period. Multiplicity of altars. Obviously referred to in the historical book. And he says it's difficult to be satisfied with saying that the worship in each case at these different altars was illegal. He points out that there are examples of worship that were illegal, not in accordance with the law. For example, in Judges 17, the worship that Micah promoted, that's one of those latter chapters in the book of Judges where that private sanctuary was set up with the Levites, obviously with the idolatry involved, illegal worship. Also, the sin of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, in setting up his calf at Bethel and at Dan, it certainly was a rival worship to the worship in Jerusalem. and as such was condemned as a sin. But all of that, he says, does not take away from the fact that in this period, the multiplicity of altars is not condemned, but sanctioned. Now, for example, he points out a number of cases. In the case of Elijah, that's in the time of Ahab, in the northern kingdom, where he opposes Baal worship and the prophets of Baal. After that showdown, so to speak, on Mount Carmel, 1 Kings 19, when Jezebel goes after Elijah, he becomes very discouraged. Perhaps that after, let me see the context here. He's fleeing from Jezebel. He goes out into the wilderness in 1 Kings 19, verse 10, as he's in a cave resting, and the Lord says, "What do you do here, Elijah?" He says, "I have been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with a sword, and I am left. And I seek to take my life, also to take it away." One of Elijah's complaints is the people of the Lord had thrown down his altars, in the plural, and had abandoned the altars of the Lord, and apparently were following the heathen altars. It wasn't long before that where up on Carmel himself, Elijah erected an altar. In 1 Kings 18, verse 31, Elijah took 12 stones, according to the number of the tribes of the sons of Jacob. With the stones, he built an altar in the name of the Lord. He made a trench about the altar. And then he prayed, and the Lord responded to that prayer. And you don't get the slightest hint that there is any illegality connected with his building an altar, apart from the Jerusalem altar. And you get the suggestion, at least, in 1 Kings 19, verse 10, that a point of valid criticism against the Israelites of that time was that they destroyed the Lord's altar. It is also at least of interest, as Hall were to point out, that we never read once a prophetic opposition against multiplicity of altars. There is no element of the prophetic message that is explicitly directed against multiplicity of altars. Now, if that was an issue, you could, this is an argument from silence, which never is the strongest argument, but you could at least charge the prophets with neglect of this issue. Why didn't the prophets come out strongly against multiplicity of altars? The books of Samuel are particularly important. Samuel was a prophet. He was a reformer. He built various altars, and he sacrificed at various altars. In 1 Samuel chapter 9, he goes to a high place of Ramah and offers a sacrifice in a town named Ramah. In 1 Samuel 7 and 1 Samuel 10, he offers sacrifices at Mizpah. And in 1 Samuel 11, verse 15, he offers one at Gilgal. So you have explicit mention, of Samuel offering at Ramah, Mizpah, and Gilgal. You also have the reference in 1 Samuel 16:2 of his making an offering in Bethlehem. Which seems to be quite a normal thing, because Notice the context. The Lord said to Samuel, "How long wilt thou mourn for Saul, seeing I have rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill thine horn with oil, go, I will send thee to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided me a king among his sons. Go anoint one of the sons of Jesse." Samuel says, "How can I go? If Saul heareth, he will kill me." Saul was the king. He's going to go anoint another king. Saul's going to oppose that. The Lord says, "Take an heifer with thee and say, I'm going to come to sacrifice to the Lord." That seems like it would have been such a normal practice for someone to take a heifer and go to Bethlehem to sacrifice that it would have aroused no curiosity whatever on the part of Saul. In a subsequent occasion, after David had been anointed, and Saul was still king, David was not at his place at the table of Saul in 1 Samuel 20. And it seems like when Saul's curiosity is aroused as to why David wasn't there, you find in 1 Samuel 20, verse 24, David hid himself in the field. When the new moon was come, the king sat down to eat. The king sat upon a seat, as at other times, even upon a seat by the wall. Jonathan arose, Abner sat by Saul's side, and David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul spoke not anything that day, for he thought, "Something has befallen him. He is not clean. Surely he is not clean." In other words, it seems that it must have been some sort of a cultic meal, because the first thought is he wasn't ritually able to come. But then, comes past the second day, the month when David's place was empty, Saul said to Jonathan, "Why comes not the son of Jesse to the table, neither yesterday nor day?" Jonathan answered to Saul, "David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. He said, let me go, I pray thee, for our family hath a sacrifice in the city. My brother hath commanded me to be there." So again, he went to Bethlehem. Why? To offer sacrifice. And his brother had commanded him to be there. And that was the reason why then he wasn't at Saul's table. So that local offering was apparently the custom in that time, and no one saw any deviation from the law because someone was going to a place to offer sacrifice. But then some say these were unstable times. The temple had not yet been built. And Deuteronomy 12:10 says, "When he giveth you rest from your enemies round about." Notice Deuteronomy 12, verse 10. "When you go over the Jordan, dwell in the land which the Lord your God gives you to inherit. When he giveth you rest from all your enemies round about, so that ye dwell in safety, then there shall be a place which the Lord your God shall choose to cause his name to dwell there." In other words, after the Israelites achieve rest, then there will be this centralized worship. So that frequently the point is made, Deuteronomy says this, and that 2 Samuel 7:11 is the point at which those conditions were realized. Now, 2 Samuel 7 is that chapter which contains the promises of the Lord to David concerning his house, that the Lord was going to establish it forever. When David had asked if he could build a house for the Lord, and in verse 11 it says, "And as since the time that I commanded judges to be over my people Israel, and have caused thee to rest from all thine enemies, also the Lord telleth thee that he will make thee in house." Now, some have tried to argue then that from any citation of multiplicity of altars prior to 2 Samuel 7, therefore, doesn't make the case because multiplicity was permissible until the Lord gave rest, until this situation was established of peace in which centrality of worship could then function well. But even if that's the case, it doesn't help with the Elijah passage. And in addition, Absalom, for example, even after 2 Samuel 7:11, organized his revolution at a sanctuary in Hebron. 2 Samuel 15, David sanctions the wish of his son to go there and pay a vow. Again, excuses made about going somewhere to sacrifice. In 2 Samuel 15, verse 7, it came to pass after 40 years, Absalom said to the king, I pray thee, let me go and pay my vow, which I have vowed unto the Lord in Hebron. For thy servant vowed a vow while he was in Syria, saying, if the Lord shall bring me again to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord. And David grants that to his son, and of course he goes to Absalom, he goes to Hebron, and starts a revolution there. But the occasion for that is, again, paying a vow, offering a sacrifice. In addition, and these are Paul Worthy's response to this 2 Samuel 7 thing, if external enemies are meant by this matter of rest or peace, Holward says application of the rule of Deuteronomy 12 is only really possible during the time of Solomon and then for very brief periods later. Because if you're talking about external enemies, almost constantly throughout Israel's history as a nation, there were external enemies. There were very short periods only where there was not threat from external enemies. So that Holward says the rest referred to in Deuteronomy 12 does not have reference to external enemies, but to internal, and that the achievement of that condition really is referred to in Joshua 22, verse 4, right at the conclusion of the conflict. Joshua 22, verse 4. And in Joshua 22, after the conquest, and the 2.5 tribes are sent home, we read in verse 4, now the Lord your God hath given rest unto your brethren as he promised us. Now therefore return ye, get you unto your tents, unto the land of your possession, which Moses the servant of the Lord gave in the other side. But take diligent heed to do the commandments and the law. So that he sees the rest referred to in the promises of Deuteronomy as fulfilled long before the time of David, fulfilled in the time of Joshua. Yeah. All right, then to go a bit further. The Exodus 20, verses 24 to 26 passage. What is the point of the regulations there?